In the coming week, U.S. lawmakers near a $2 trillion coronavirus relief deal as debate intensifies over economic pain versus lockdown efforts. Indians enter a nationwide 21-day lockdown, and fragile states and refugee camps begin to grapple with virus concerns. It's March 26, 2020, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, I want to note for our listeners that you and I are practicing social distancing, and we are recording this podcast from our respective homes. So we apologize in advance if audio issues crop up or if our family members make an unannounced appearance on the show. With that disclaimer out of the way, let's start our look at the week ahead with the coronavirus. Bob, can you give us what the military likes to call a SITREP, a situation report?
Sure. It's becoming a challenge to keep pace with the spread of this virus, Jim, but let's run through some numbers. We've got close to 70,000 cases in the U.S. now. For those who are keeping a scorecard, as it were, that's pushing the U.S. closer to the number one outbreak zone of cases, which is China, which is, I think, 81,000 cases as the outbreak slows to a stall there. In the U.S., there's been more than 1,000 U.S. deaths now. As mentioned at the outset, $2.2 trillion package is nearing a deal in Congress. And the epicenter in the U.S. is New York, where close to half of the cases have been reported. Some of this, we should note, is skewed by testing, where testing is available and it's becoming more available in New York. You're seeing more cases, certainly in New York, than elsewhere. It's also worldwide. There are close to 500,000 cases, Jim, 22,000 dead, and areas of alarm outside. Now that China has been in subsidence and much of Asia has been, it should be noted, Europe are areas of particular concern. Italy with the highest number of deaths, Spain catching up pretty quickly. And in addition to the U.S., there are the so-called economic bazookas being prepared in Europe as well. Germany announced a very large package this week as well. And the European Union is having what will be one of many multilateral virtual discussions today to talk about a collective approach to countering the virus. So it is very much a full-fledged pandemic, Jim, and there is a lot to say about the extent to which the world is trying to sync up its approach, both in the aftermath, in the terms of the historic slowdown and really lockdown in many places, or whether it's a world of nation states going about things largely on their own.
Bob, let's look at the United States in particular. You mentioned that New York has emerged as the leading hotspot. I think that's a term that's commonly being used. Where are we also seeing a spike in coronavirus cases?
In the U.S., you're seeing New Orleans. You've already seen it on parts of the West Coast. The initial hotspot was an elder care home in Kirkland, Washington, Washington State. But there are also parts of California that have also seen hotspots. If you had sort of a heat map showing this, you'd see certainly coastal areas clustered around the Northeast and New York, Long Island. You'd see New Orleans. I think Texas is starting to report some surging cases. Florida, there are some cases emerging. It's not close to what it could be. There's a great deal of concern about Florida becoming an outbreak zone because of the large number of senior citizens who have sought Florida out for retirement, but also the large number of New York to Florida connections and the number of people who were traveling to Florida right up until an announcement was made by the White House that urged anybody who, you know, in recent days has left New York to self-quarantine for 14 days. This gets to something else, Jim, which is this sort of inconsistent approach across the U.S. to the way in which advice is being handed out. You know, in some places it's advice, in some places it's mandated, in some places it's strongly suggested. You're seeing people sort of living by their own devices, and it really varies, you know, almost city to city, county to county, in how much people are self-restricting their movements.
Bob, I think you are touching on both the benefits and the downside to federalism. As you mentioned, a lot of these decisions are being made on the state and local level. Last count I saw, 21 states have instituted some form of a lockdown or a shelter in place. 15 of those states have Democratic governors, 6 have Republican governors. They tend to be states that have big cities in which infections have already begun to take root, note to Louisiana. But one of the downside, of course, is that some states are being very slow. And I know Florida has been criticized for doing very little when the outbreak first became known to discourage people from going to beaches. We have all the discussion about spring break and spring breakers bringing the virus back to their family. And again, this is One of the big problems that if a state, pick one, Illinois does a really good job of getting people to stay home and break the progression of the disease, if its neighboring state or even a state across the country doesn't succeed in doing it because we have social mobility, the disease comes back and defeats the purpose of the lockdown.
No, it's a really good point, Jim. And so you've seen clusters of states responding in unison. You saw it roughly happening at the same time with like New York, for example. There's so much tri-state activity that goes on around New York City, New Jersey, Connecticut, New York, that there was a stress on those states sort of acting in unison. It seems to be the case now. I'm not sure if that's totally the case, but obviously Governor Cuomo in New York is getting a lot of attention because of his regular briefings and his attempt to try to kind of seize the narrative about control and mitigation and so forth. In the Washington, D.C. area where we live, Jim, you had the Maryland governor and the D.C. mayor taking what looked to be more severe steps early on, and the Virginia governor where I live, Ralph Northam, a little bit more of a slow walking of this, expressing concern about the immediate impact on the economy. And then you had Governor Northam step forward and announce, okay, school is out for the rest of the semester for all Virginia students. And so that was quite a sweeping step that took place. But I do think you are seeing the three leaders in this region now trying to work more closely in common cause. But these are only pockets in the country, and it's not any sort of a federal top-down effort. It's partly the way this country acts on all sorts of fronts.
So looking at it, we had a lot of talk about flattening the curve. Have we seen any evidence that the curve is being flattened?
I would only note that there are some indications out of New York, which is still very much the epicenter, that you've seen a slowing in the number of, in the acceleration of cases there, which could be indicative of a slowing down. Although given the size of New York and given the belief spread and the amount of testing going on, that still could be variable. So that's one sign. I'm not sure you can say that U.S. would be an eligible country for flattening the curve. There's a chart that's making the rounds. It gets a lot of attention from the Financial Times showing the trajectory of cases. And the U.S. is almost on a vertical, or has been until recently, almost on a vertical, Jim. So no flattening going on, or really serious flattening we can talk about or boast of at the moment in the U.S. as contrasted with Asia, again, where there have been extensive testing in places like South Korea, for example, severe lockdown in places including China and Taiwan, Singapore. And again, to the extent where like Hubei province, where this virus originated by all accounts, is now signaling it's going back to normalcy and in terms of going back to business. Obviously, things are not normal. You're seeing photos coming out of Hubei where factories are now up, but you're showing pictures of workers during lunch breaks distancing themselves and taking, you know, their 6-foot zone of open space between them and their fellow workers as they have their lunches and so forth. But back to your original question, the flattening of the curve is not something we're talking about in terms of the U.S. context at this point. And that leads to another issue, which is at the same time, given the extent of the economic sort of trauma going on in the U.S. and real angst, frankly, across the board, you had President Trump signaling, hey, you know, this country needs something to fasten onto. And he signaled that we should be aiming to get back to some semblance of normalcy by Easter, which is April 12th.
17 days from today.
This has triggered a huge debate, Jim. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this sort of cure worse than the disease type bait that's really starting to spread throughout the country.
Certainly, Bob. I mean, that has been the big debate going on all week. It was touched off in many ways by an appearance by Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who was on, I think, the Tucker Carlson show. And he basically talked about how he thought people should get back to work, get back to living. I think those are the words he used. And he went on to say that those of us who are 70 plus will take care of ourselves. And again, it's focused at this suspicion, concern that the steps we're taking to combat the virus are actually derailing the economy and that our cost-benefit analysis is out of whack. And as you mentioned, the president has raised this, and there's been a lot of pushback from people in the public health community, because what they note is that from their point of view, unless you crack down, what's going to happen is this virus is going to spread and you're going to have an even bigger impact on the economy. So a lot of this debate turns on differing priorities people would put on public health versus the health of the economy. But a lot of it also hinges on assumptions people make about what would be effective in dealing with the outbreak. And I think a lot of it's also affected by where people are. Because as we just spoke, Bob, we have some parts of the country, hotspots. Think New York, think Washington, Seattle area, think of California, potentially in Louisiana. There, the crisis is immediate. If you're watching local news, you're seeing how your hospitals are being affected. If you go beyond to a place where the cases really haven't begun to mount, this crisis seems a little bit more distant. You're a little bit more skeptical that it's really going to be that bad. And I think that's affecting a lot of what's going on. And the real risk to us in all of this is that we're going to end up with half measures. That is, we're going to sort of take some steps to try to slow down the progress of the virus or its transmission, that those steps will hurt the economy, but they won't be enough to actually stop the virus from spreading. I think that's the real danger we're at. And it goes back to the point we were discussing a moment ago, where you have different rules in different areas. And the problem is people move and virus goes with them. So I think a lot of people right now are worrying about, let's take New York. If New York succeeds in flattening the curve, New York begins to go back to normal. Is New York all of a sudden, a month, 2-3 months down the road, going to face a second wave of infection from people bringing the infection back into the community? And again, how bad that might be will depend upon how good is testing. Do we come up with ways to treat it and the like? So there's a lot of moving parts here.
Part of this also gets at, you alluded to it earlier with mentioning sort of the red state, blue state governors and so forth, is the extent to which the guidance of epidemiologists, of health experts, pandemic experts is followed. And that guidance includes taking extra precautions, even that seem too excessive, versus a sense of trying to seize the reins on the economic front and perhaps downplaying health guidance for the sake of a broader belief in economic vitality. And some have tried to paint it as a, you know, yet another area of red state, blue state divide in the U.S. It's a little bit more nuanced than that, although there is something to that as well. And it would be truly unfortunate if this is another area that the country found itself foundering on in an election year, of all things, in terms of the way it treated and responded to something that has, in all effects, shut down the country in many different ways. It's not just the small businesses and being able to dine out in restaurants and go to bars. But, you know, we see it this week with the silence on opening day for baseball. Major sport leagues have shut down. Schools have been closed. Artistic venues have been closed. I mean, it's the life of a nation. It's also the psyche of a nation. And it's a time to just pull together. And it seems like the argument is not going in a productive direction, but a divisive one.
Well, certainly, Bob. But I think, I mean, we can't lose sight of the fact that the economy is getting hammered by the disruption caused by the coronavirus. News came out today that U.S. unemployment claims jumped 3.8 million this past week. That's the largest jump in history.
6 times higher than the previous highest level, I believe.
The previous high. So that tells you how sharp this contraction is. And this is hurting people. It's hurting big businesses. It's hurting small businesses. It's hurting individuals. People are losing their jobs. I mean, my daughter lost her job because of the virus. The place she worked had to close down. And there are real concerns about how long this is going to last and how you get started again. And I think that's obviously motivating this debate. I happen to live in downtown Washington, D.C., and when I go out, I go by restaurant after bar after small business, and they're all closed, and you have to wonder how they are going to stay afloat. You know, a lot of it depends upon how long this lasts, but this takes us back to, as you noted at the top of the show, lawmakers are nearing completion on a $2 billion relief package, and the Senate voted on it last night unanimously. Now it waits action in the House. I think the House is likely to take it up tomorrow. Could get momentarily delayed, especially as members on both sides discover specifics in the bill that they don't like. But this, it's going to get passed because the sense of urgency is there to get it passed. And it's sometimes described as a stimulus bill, but I would really call it more a bill to patch the U.S. social safety net, both for individuals and businesses. You know, a big part of the individual side is we're going to have expanded unemployment benefits, followed by one-time checks of, I think it's $1,200 for individuals with an adjusted gross income going up to about $75,000. And if you're a married couple, you get $2,400, assuming your adjusted gross income doesn't exceed $150,000, and then additional money for children. And likewise, there's money to aid small businesses, money for big corporations. What's really interesting is that Secretary of Treasury Steve Mnuchin indicated today that the United States may take an equity stake in some companies if it goes in and essentially performs a bailout. Now, of course, You know, this is probably not going to be the last major piece of legislation Congress has to pass in dealing with the economic effects of the coronavirus. And we're going to see how that all plays out down the road. And there's a real potential if this lasts, and sort of have a rolling series of crises, that it may be very difficult to get the economy up and running again, even though we are talking about spending $2 trillion, which is 10% of U.S. GDP.
Yeah, and it's been mentioned that there could be further phases of such relief. And again, you're right to call it relief. I think most economists are saying that this is really a relief phase. There could be a stimulus phase down the road that's also of gigantic proportions. So at this point, it's kind of a freeze to try to keep things in place while the country sorts things out and then moves forward. Yeah. So it's all new territory here.
It certainly is. And what looms over all of this is, number one, interest rates are almost at zero, which effectively means that the things the Fed would normally do, which is to cut interest rates, they've gone there. Likewise, we're talking about a country right now. We were already on the road to have a deficit of $1 trillion for this fiscal year. That number is going to continue to go north. And there's going to be eventually real debate about how much money can we in fact borrow to get the economy going. And so I think this is a debate that is going to continue for quite some time. It's going to be again complicated by the fact that we may just be in the first phase of infection. We may succeed in flattening the curve, but that doesn't mean that infections won't pop up again, requiring a repeat of some of these steps and where you basically have to shut society down to slow the transmission. But Bob, having said that, let's pivot to India, world's most populous democracy, where this past week, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi imposed a nationwide 21-day lockdown for its 1.3 billion people. Take us into the decision, Bob, and tell us a little bit more about how a lockdown is playing out in a country that has nowhere near the kind of infrastructure, health or otherwise, that the United States or any other Western economy would have.
Yes, Jim. Well, anytime you talk about India, you're talking about aspects on an epic scale. And this is certainly one of those. A 21-day lockdown for 1.3 billion people has never been attempted before, as far as anyone knows. And this is a country that, as has been noted repeatedly, has a very large informal economy. We were just talking about the U.S. economy, you know, largest in the world and highly mobilized and much more easy to kind of track in many ways. India is not that. And it's still very early days on this. The announcement just came out a couple of days ago, but you're already seeing things like some of India's states, which have a great deal of autonomy and decision-making, you know, sort of holding things up at their borders in terms of supply lorries and things like that, that are trying to bring in, you know, you name it, from groceries to medical supplies to whatever. That's becoming a bit of a snare right now. India's going to have to navigate that. One thing that has been pointed out on India, and again, it's early, we'll have to see how things pan out. And I should add, by the way, India has a small number of reported cases at this point, in the hundreds, very small number of deaths attributed to coronavirus, but also nothing like the testing necessary and the testing capabilities, as you alluded to, Jim, that some of its Asian neighbors has. But what India has had and has shown in the past, and some reporting has pointed out this week, is it has shown a capability to be, let's say, mission focused. So India successfully, for example, ran a campaign to eradicate polio in something like 170 million of its children. India's recent exercises in voting involved on the order of 900 million people, and they were considered to be relatively free, fair, and decently run elections by all accounts. So we'll see whether this unprecedented health crisis also causes India to rally in this fashion or not and brings to the fore the resilience of the Indian people. But it's going to be quite something to behold. And when you talk about some of the things we're talking about in some of the Western cities, you know, the social distancing and, you know, the self-quarantining and so forth, it's hard to imagine some of those things being enacted in cities the size of Mumbai and New Delhi and Calcutta and so forth. Also a country with a large number of impoverished people, even though it has grown quite a bit in recent years, still huge numbers of impoverished, huge urban areas. It's just a new kind of a test, Jim.
Oh, it certainly is, Bob. And I think you know, rightly point to the challenge in any high density population to slow the transmission of a virus that is quite infectious. But I'm also struck as you describe the steps that Prime Minister Modi is taking in India to stop the disease, because it reminds me of the situation we just discussed here in the United States. That is, here in the United States, some state governors have jumped on this issue, put through lockdowns, asked people to stop meeting in groups, you know, greater than 2, greater than 5, greater than 10. But other states have sort of held back, haven't taken those steps. We're seeing the same thing on the international front. So India imposes a national lockdown for a country of 1.3 billion people. But if you come here to the Western Hemisphere, there are two notable countries, Brazil and Mexico, where their leaders are not taking those steps and indeed are encouraging people to keep going out and continue with a normal life. And I'm talking about Brazil and I'm talking about Mexico. What's really interesting in Brazil, which has a federal system in ways similar to the United States, you're seeing governors take precautions, particularly in those states that have big cities, like the governor of the state in which Sao Paulo is in. But they were criticized by President Bolsonaro for what they're doing. And it's really interesting. In Rio, I've seen reports that the organized criminal groups that run the favelas, these sort of shanty town neighborhoods, are themselves imposing lockdowns because the government won't do it itself. Then you go to Mexico, where President Lopez Obrador has basically dismissed the threat posed by the coronavirus. He himself is still going out and shaking hands and meeting crowds. And we're starting to see cases start to pop up in Mexico, like Brazil, like India. It would be hard pressed to deal with a major outbreak of the coronavirus. So you're sort of seeing this very uneven reaction to it. And that creates a problem because people cross borders. They always have, they always will. And with people go microbes.
It's an excellent point, Jim. And it's just another curious point about the Brazil case you mentioned is sort of an inordinate number of high-level Brazilian officials have caught the virus, actually have tested positive for it. There was some confusion about whether Mr. Bolsonaro himself had it. Seems like he has not. But despite that, has not seemed to trouble federal-level officials, although apparently they're in some federal agencies, there has been pretty intense debate about the steps that should be taken. But this brings to mind what I mentioned much earlier in the podcast, Jim, which is we've had now a series of multilateral meetings in a virtual capacity this week. There's one that's due to take place right around the time we finish this podcast, Jim, hosted by Saudi Arabia, which is the nominal host of the G20 this year. And that is a leadership level meeting. There have been some foreign minister level meetings like the G7, for example. And it's been a bit of a mixed result, to say the least. For example, the G7 meeting that concluded yesterday was not able to agree on a final statement because of disagreement over how to label the virus. The U.S. had been stressing it should be called the Wuhan virus from the city of origin. Yep. And that had been resisted pretty strongly by the other G7 countries that wanted to either some variation of coronavirus, or there's a long set of acronyms that's also attached to the name, couldn't agree on it. That apparently there are efforts between the U.S. and China to smooth things over ahead of today's G20 meeting and to try to present some common cause. We'll have to see, but it's a G20 which sort of emerged from the crisis of 2008 as this global organization that wasn't just fiscally sort of founded initially, but seemed to become a practical organization for countries that are on the move, either the biggest countries or the biggest emerging countries, to try to solve these types of problems. And I think the world could really use some basic collective on the same page guidance from the leading countries in the world about how to pursue lockdowns. And it also gets to the duration. I mean, we mentioned India's 21 days. What happens after 21 days are over there? No one knows, you know? Yep. So if people's stress level and angst level is high now, given the measures currently in place in the U.S. or anywhere, think of how distressing it will be if there's a loop back of this virus and things open and then are forced to close again, or there's a muddle and there's a healthcare scare. It's a very concerning area. It's a time, really, if of any time, we could really use some global guidance.
On that score, Bob, I mean, that leadership, global leadership, typically, at least for the last 70 years, has been provided by the United States. And President Trump is not interested in playing that leadership role. And leaders are important because that's how you overcome what economists call the collective action problem. That is the tendency of everybody to hope somebody else will do the hard work. And it's a real shame that we haven't seen the administration leverage U.S. influence and visibility to get a more coordinated response to this. And I think that has played into why you have a bunch of different countries going off in different ways, even though those decisions each individual country makes has consequences for others. And I will note, I mentioned President Lopez Obrador a moment ago. I believe it was the president of Costa Rica actually has tweeted begging him to take steps against the coronavirus because the rest of Central America is deeply worried about what happens if the virus takes root in Mexico. So this really is we're all in this together. And likewise, you mentioned the need for coordination I do think we're going to face a big challenge in a number of refugee camps. I'm thinking most notably refugees in Syria and Yemen, where this could be catastrophic. And our colleague Gail Lamont has a piece at CNN on just this point. She spent a lot of time in the region, and it's just heartbreaking what tragedies could flow out of that.
No, it's a really good point. It's yet another area where collective, concerted global action could be effective. The United Nations has made a $2 billion appeal to help the countries that don't have the bazookas to bear against this virus, but also those stateless people who are in the hundreds of millions in places like Bangladesh or Turkey or North Africa or whatever, to take some steps against this. The Red Cross has also just issued an appeal today, something like $800 million that it's asking for. And as Gail points out in her piece, there's a common humanity response that should be in order here. But there is also a practical sort of self-preservation aspect to this, which is if this is allowed to get out of control in a refugee camp, in a displaced person camp, it's not going to stay there. We've already seen the way this virus has behaved, incredibly contagious, and it's fluid. And it really, again, cries out for some playbook, at least starting with hopefully the virtual meetings going on this week, some set of collective marching orders about how to proceed in terms of dealing within countries that are hotspots, but also other places where it could break out.
I'm very skeptical of going to see that kind of coordinated international action. Just going back to where you began this segment, Bob, we have the United States trying to blame China. And as we discussed last week, we have China trying to go out and reshape the narrative where it's not the country that helped bring the problem about, but it's the country that spared everybody else or give everybody else time to act. So I think there's a lot of focusing on issues that aren't the main issue that governments need to be addressing.
Well, Jim, I think we've set the table for our segment that we're not going to abandon, which is the figure of the week. So who or what is your figure of the week, Jim?
Bob, my figure of the week is a person. I am going to go with Chairman Kim Jong-un of North Korea. Over the last week or so, North Korea has reminded everybody that it is a country that has ballistic missiles. It launched a couple of short-range ballistic missiles on March 20th, and these were fired off of North Korea's eastern coast. They landed in the waters between North Korea and Japan. Obviously, this solicited a reaction in Seoul and in Japan. Seoul, in particular, called the actions deeply inappropriate, and it reminds us that the North Korean problem has not been solved, even if we're talking about the coronavirus rather than the North Korean ballistic and nuclear weapons program. One of the things lurking in the background is what is the course of the COVID-19 disease in North Korea? No one really knows. Official state media says that they haven't had a problem. But, you know, many North Korean experts would tell you that this is a country that has every incentive to cover up any outbreak. And I will note that President Trump sent Chairman Kim a letter last week offering to help North Korea in its battle against the coronavirus. I'm not aware that the North Koreans have responded either privately or publicly to that. But again, you know, we talk a lot about the coronavirus. A lot of other problems in foreign policy continue to poke along, even as we're talking about microbes and pandemics. What about you, Bob? Who or what is your figure of the week?
Well, Jim, I'm going to loop us back to virus-related development, and I'll mention the year 2021, which is now the next time we can expect to look toward possible Summer Olympic Games. This past week, Japan, in consultation with the International Olympic Committee, announced it would not be holding the Tokyo Games this summer. It had held off actually for quite a while. And even though the late July, which is when the games are to begin, still seems a bit off, there were too many factors involved that were going to make this a very difficult games to hold. It would be quite a somber affair if they did go ahead with it. Among other things, you know, there's a great deal of athletes who need to go through various Olympic trials and competitions involving many other athletes right at this time period, and that just could not happen. There was a great deal of coordination that had to take place in consultation with the sponsors, the people who make these games possible, you know, whether it's the big corporate sponsors, whether it's broadcasters like NBC or whatever, and all the various national sports committees that contribute to getting these 11,000 or so athletes ready to compete. It's going to be an enormous logistical undertaking to reorient calendars and make the Olympics happen in an off year. But again, this is a year like no others, so we're in for yet another area of history making on the sports front, Jim.
certainly are, Bob. And I know, having been in Japan recently, the Japanese people were very excited about hosting the Olympics. Everybody was looking forward to it. It's an opportunity for, as a host country, to show yourself to the world what you can do. But it's also a real heartbreak for these athletes who have been training for quite a long time to be able to make Olympic teams. And many of them have made great sacrifices as individuals to be in a position to be able to compete in these sports. And now they're put on hold, and they're not even really sure that they're going to have this opportunity in 2021, despite all the intentions, precisely because nobody knows how this disease is going to progress and evolve. Do we see the second, third wave of it? Does somebody come up with treatments that are very effective? Do we end up having a speed breakthrough and can create a vaccine that would allow life to return to normal? A lot of unknown sorts of things, but certainly for the people of Japan who are looking forward to this, for the athletes who shed a lot of sweat and blood and time and effort to get ready for these games, it's a significant loss. And I can remember when the U.S. participation in the Moscow Games back in 1980 were canceled, how many athletes around the United States were deeply disappointed to have lost their chance. And it brings back some memories from, I guess, 40 years ago.
That's the only thing in my lifetime I can compare this to, Jim, in terms of this quadrennial event and people, you know, working in that time period to train for, you name it. And I think back to 1980, you know, whether it was American gymnasts or track and field stars or whatever. And in those days in particular, I think there was less professionalization in some of these sports. Yep. And so that was their ticket, and it was dashed, and it was hard to argue with it. It was in response, you know, the U.S. boycotted the Moscow Games in response to the invasion of Afghanistan. There was a tit for tat response when L.A. hosted the Games in 84, but I think there's very fond memories of the L.A. Games for lots of reasons. They still took place, as did the Moscow Games for that matter. This now, though, there's just so many unanswered questions. Yep. My heart really goes out to the Japanese, the hosts, but also these athletes, and I really hope they're able to come up with something that results in it being some sort of a capstone event where kind of the world can come together. That sounds a bit kumbaya, but it is something that I do hope can happen, as I do on all the major sports events that have been, at this point, taken off the books. Let's see how this year plays out. But first and foremost, let's get this health crisis solved.
Agreed.
And that's our look at the pandemic-riddled world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. Argentina marks Malvinas Day, and Earth Hour is recognized across the globe.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks to Anu Kumar, Claire McGraw, and Anna Shortridge for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collis. Yes, she's also our producer. Thank you, Zoe, for pulling double duty. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrera and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying, stay healthy.
And this is Bob McMahon echoing that and saying so long.